Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 93 of Registry Matters. You know what? In a week or two, I'm not going to be able to say East and West. I'm going to have to use the underground bunker, I think.
It will be next week. We'll be recording from the underground bunker on Sunday. So people need to be aware that they will probably get the podcast a little bit late, because I do not imagine from the distance to drive to the bunker and the time I get in around 5 or 6 o'clock and I get settled, I doubt you're going to want to drive up to the bunker and do a recording Saturday evening.
That's possibly true. I might have other things to do.
So we'll probably be doing it Sunday morning.
And then the following week, things get all messed up, too, because that's when the Georgia meeting is, right? Or is that next weekend also?
Well, we were going to record at the library.
Okay, that's right. So that's it. We're making the formal announcement that if you want to see us record a show, we're going to record at the library. Go to the RSOL Georgia webpage, and you can find the details about the event. And you can come join us for a live recording of the Registry Matters podcast, which should be a hoot.
Yes, I suspect that we'll probably pack that library and have them just like it was in Houston.
That's right. We needed police to direct traffic, and panties were being thrown and all that.
So I'm quite confident that once they know that Registry Matters is recording, that there will be a flock of people that will sign up for that RSOL meeting.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. Larry, we had two new patrons this week, and I am always, always excited about getting new patrons. And we got a Brendan and a Brian. Thank you guys so much. Brian came in at a shockingly high level, and want to send out a very special, super special thank you to Brian for being so very generous.
I'm hoping that we can provide value for that. You feel a sense of love offering there when someone makes a commitment at that level, but we hope we can earn that.
That is the objective. We are honestly trying to provide some value to these people. You people, as Larry likes to say, you people, and provide you with some value and compelling articles and ideas on how we can push back and change the world, as it were. We have a bunch of articles, and we have a couple listener questions. We got a clip from Scalia, and then you are going to dive into tiering versus leveling, and we're going to talk about that as being like the feature segment of the show tonight. And with that, are you ready to start hitting some of these articles, all of which you did? I didn't do any of this week. This was all you this week.
Well, don't blame him. Blame me for the crap that we're talking about this week.
Send all your hate mail to oldcrotchetylarry@gmail.com.
Oh, crotchety Larry. I wonder if anybody has that email.
This first article comes from The Appeal, and it's Harris County DA seeks execution of intellectually disabled man. In reading through this, Larry, somebody that has an IQ of 70, and then there's some margin of error that they talk about. I assume that on different days of the week, different times of day, that your IQ probably can be evaluated to be different. But they say this guy, he'll go in and he'll get $32 change, and he'll be handed $3, and he doesn't realize that he has been shorted $29 of change. He can't complete sentences, and yet here he is on death row, and this DA is pushing to have him executed, but she's also claiming that she's a progressive kind of DA. Did I characterize that sort of right?
That's precisely correct. That's why I put the article in here. Harris County is Houston, and Houston being so large has led Texas and sending people to death row. And Kim Ogg, who ran as a reform-minded district attorney, has fallen far short, which is quite common when people, our own Ronald Torres ran as a reformer, and he's fallen far short of our expectations. But I put this in here to let people know it's going to tie together with next week's Scalia clip, because Scalia talks about the how the court has interpreted and continued to evolve its prohibition on the death penalty, which he says was never even contemplated at the time of the framers' founding. in the Constitution. So I should have possibly used that clip this week. But she ran, for the point of this article, she ran as a reformer. And as you dig into the story, you find out that she actually was an advocate for the death penalty, has been for some time. And this is not what I think the people of Harris County thought they were getting when they elected her. So I'm disappointed that I mean, it's kind of a bait and switch.
It feels like, and I don't know if we want to dig into the upcoming candidates on the Democratic side, but Kamala Harris she's talking about all this criminal justice reform stuff, but she was kind of a pretty tough prosecutor out there. This sort of feels like the same thing then.
Sure does. And these appeal articles are always long, but it says from 2002 to 2007, Ogg served on the board of directors of the Houston-based Justice for All, a pro-death penalty victims advocacy group. So it's clear that she's been pro-death penalty for some number of years.
Why is it a problem to execute someone? Let me play devil's advocate and be the asshole for a minute. Somebody's established a line for the IQ to be, if you are over this, then you are eligible to be executed, which sounds a really terrible thing. Like, hey, you're the winner. But if you're below this line, then you're not. And he is like on the line, but he's there. So like there's a line for a reason. So why can't we have determined that 70 is a line before it's unconstitutional? He can be executed.
Well, that's what the state of Texas is arguing. So you've put this together succinctly.
Other than that, like this policy, like Texas is like the execution capital, at least of the United States, if I'm not mistaken. Probably Louisiana wins up there too.
Yes, Texas, but sheer size of Texas, they have more executions. What makes it tragic is that we've long since held and believed that people who are incompetent to stand trial shouldn't be forced to stand trial. Of course, if you can't stand trial, you can't be convicted. But we've had the diminished capacity and sanity defense, but that has been eroded through the years, through the decades. And it picked up a lot of momentum after Ronald Reagan was shot and his would-be assailant was found not guilty by insanity. If there hadn't been such an erosion in the mental disease or defect defense, this could possibly have been put on it as a defense. But it's almost impossible to have a successful defense that you're mentally defective on the guilt or innocence phase. So then the defense attorneys come in, they try to figure out some creative argument to save the person from the death penalty. And this is what they've come up with. Well, we can't execute a person who doesn't understand why they're being executed. Well, they shouldn't ever be in this point to begin with. If they couldn't understand the process that was happening against them, they weren't supposed to go on trial to start with and be convicted.
Yeah. I don't really think that we try to go into what the case is. And I mean, the person did commit a pretty horrible offense in the mid-2000s. Obviously that is taken into account of you have to be accountable for your actions. And so it says the guy's name is Johnson. So Johnson sexually assaulted and he and a co-defendant took the victim into the woods and shot them. Like that's pretty high up there as far as heinous crime. So do we want those people in society? I mean, I'm trying to ask the jerk off questions, Larry, honestly.
Well, don't we have other options? I mean, that's not, do we want them in society or execution? Don't we have some remediation in between, therefore we can keep them out of society?
As in, just black and white, right? So we could let them go free or execute. They're somewhere else?
Yeah, wouldn't we be able to keep him incarcerated like we did with Charles Manson for the rest of his life?
We certainly would.
Oh, I know that costs money.
Yes, but putting these people through 3, 4, 5 appeals processes costs a truckload of money too.
I think the evidence shows that the putting a person to death costs more than imprisoning them for life most often. Of course, there's an exception to everything. If a person is 74 years old when they get put on death row, if they live long enough to actually be executed, it probably wouldn't cost as the person who's 20 years old that does something, puts them on prison for life. You can spend an awful lot of money as they age out before they die. But as a general rule, I think the evidence shows that putting a capital punishment is very expensive.
But someone that has, of average, normal IQ, maybe a little above average, and they commit a crime, you would expect putting them through the quote-unquote rehabilitative process of our prison system that they would, I'm here inside these walls. I probably should think about why I'm here, and maybe I can change my behavior in the future. This guy isn't probably, I don't want to sell him short, but he probably isn't able to then figure out what's going on to figure out that he did something wrong to then correct the behavior on the other side.
Possibly, but even if he could, the point I was wanting to hammer out is this is a person who presented herself as a progressive.
True.
This is not generally what most progressives stand for. They're not usually pro-capital punishment. So that's all. It's kind of a bait and switch.
I understand. Yeah, I understand. Sorry for taking it in a different direction. Then let's move over to Time Magazine. This is a Florida judge releases student accused of attempted sexual assault after attorneys argue he's high achieving. This sounds just like the thing when we had the attorney Andrew Torres on with the judge. That was in New Jersey with the guy that filmed him having the relations with the young lady?
That was the one where he denied the state's motion to move right. to charge him as a dope.
Yeah. This sounds at least directly parallel to it. So this is go ahead.
What it sounds like is what it actually is that the victim's apparatus has gotten such a stranglehold on people that we have totally lost sight of this as a presumed innocent person, and the accusation is merely that it's an accusation. And putting forth arguments about what your client has achieved when he's presumed innocent or she, that's exactly what an attorney is supposed to do. And I'm just mystified as to why you're not supposed to advocate on behalf of your client in an adversarial system and say, this person is a high achiever. What are you supposed to come in there and say, oh my God, it's a pathetic loser? Keep him caged up until trial? I mean, this is the most asinine response I've heard in some time. The lawyer did exactly what a lawyer is supposed to do in an adversarial system, is to paint his accused client in the best light he possibly can, because the presumption of innocence is supposed to follow him through the duration of this proceeding. And it's not as if they send him home with a slap on the wrist. He's on ankle monitoring, and those who have been on that, it's very much debilitating. You don't go swimming very often. There's a lot of things you don't do with something strapped and attached to your ankle.
And certainly out in public, everybody knows that you're on an ankle monitor. It's not like you're hiding it. You basically could have a tattoo on your forehead with a neon sign.
Well, if you've never put on short pants, you can generally hide the monitor, but you're restricted dramatically. An innocent person on home confinement with an ankle monitor, it's not as if they're roaming the countryside. I think that when you're presumed innocent, you should be allowed to roam the countryside. You're not on probation yet.
Let me try and back up and tell you, when I read this, I I know I'm going to get chastised for this. I read it and I read what he is accused of doing and the events that took place. I felt for the victim and did not immediately go innocent until proven guilty. And that's it. Well, I lost Larry. The whole podcast is shut down because Larry won't talk to me now.
I'm not wired to ever think that way. If you have that reaction in a case, if you're in the defense business, you need to not be involved in that defendant's case because how heinous the accusations are, how they're painted in the media, may be completely overblown from the reality of what actually happened.
And as you were going through your you got a little heated there for a moment talking about this, it dawned on me that there's no further evidence behind this other than this is her statement, other than the part where she ran to a friend's house and then he showed up at her house. That's the only part that probably has corroborating evidence. But otherwise, it's just her word against his, and you would have the presumption of innocence.
Well, not according to the victim's advocate. She don't.
Yeah.
I have not shifted and converted to that belief system, but unfortunately the majority of our society seems to have done so. We have evolved to trashing the presumption of innocence, and we have bought into the notion that if you make a serious enough allegation, And it sounds bad enough that that alone should be enough to send a person away, and they should forget about due process. They should forget about all this stuff. He should just be sitting in a jail cell from the day he was arrested, and that should be the end of it. And all the lawyers should just forget about him and say, to hell with him. And that's not the America that I'd like to live in. Maybe you're happy with that, but I wouldn't be.
No, and I'm not, and I'm feeling a little bit shameful for immediately going in that direction. And somehow the lens of due process needs to show up first, and the innocent until proven guilty part and fair trial, all that should show up while reading this. That should be the lens that we read all of these articles through until jury, evidence, conviction, or acquittal.
Well, I've had this conversation so many times through the years, and they say the lawyer, he was arrested, and the lawyer pled him not guilty and asked him to be released. That's what the lawyer is supposed to do. And the news media, and he entered a plea of not guilty. That is what you're supposed to do. You don't know the specifics are well enough at the time the police arrest you. You don't know the elements of burden of proof of what every particular element is of that allegation. You don't know the evidence that they're going to align against you. You don't know all that stuff. You might know what you did. I would assume that you do, unless you're out of it. You know what you did. But what you don't know is what crime that constitutes. You don't know if they charged you accurately in the indictment. You don't know any of that until the lawyer thoroughly analyzes that and figures out if they can meet the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, if people want to believe that somehow merely that the defense lawyer's job is to interrogate the client and say, well, I guess you, since you admitted to me you've done it, we ought not even try no more to try to see if we can mitigate anything. You just go on in there and take whatever medicine they want to dish out to you. That's not the society I want to live in, because we have an adversarial system in America. We don't have this healing justice and this restorative justice and all the stuff that people wish we had. That's not what we have. We have two parties jousting, and the party that's the head of the jousting has the burden of proving. The party that's on the defending side of the jousting has a lesser burden.
Larry, do all attorneys talk like that, though? That's my question. Do all attorneys talk like that?
Like what?
The Southern drawl that you put on?
Well, when I was – no, I don't think they all talk that way. But I hear this, it amazes me that even people on our side have fallen into the belief that you should just throw in the towel because of the seriousness of the accusations and what are alleged. These are nothing but allegations at this point. That's
all they are. Yeah, I understand. I agree. And I apologize for not thinking of it that way first.
So
should we move over to this appeal article, the next one?
Yeah, I can't take this anymore.
Oh, we have to talk about the Gorge. You haven't been there recently, have you?
I have not, but we have a nice suspension bridge just north of Taos, and it has been very effective.
Effective, like 100%?
I don't think there's any documented cases of it not working.
So it's if you go over this bridge, didn't you tell me it's like 600 feet or something?
I forget the height of it, but Rio Grande Gorge Bridge, if you Google it, you'll see that it looks like it would do the job.
Gorge Bridge. Oh my God. It's too many words to type. Oh, it's Grande Gorge Bridge. You said it's in Taos? Is that what it is?
No, it's north of Taos, yeah.
Okay. First of all, it's 73 degrees, which is pretty outstanding. It's not 9:30 p.m. Yeah. What in the world? Yeah, that would do it, Larry. That would totally. That looks exactly like something that you would see in some the Road to Uma or something like that. There was a Western movie where you got the train going over the gorge. That would totally do it. That looks gorgeous.
I suspect if you get in the center of that and you take a leap, it would be effective.
Man, you should just go there and hang out because it's pretty.
I'm not advocating anyone do that, of course.
All right. From the appeal, balancing the scales of justice. This really, we should almost just like segue what we were just talking about into this. It's an adversarial system that justice presumes two equal sides, yet our criminal courts largely feature the most unequal of fights. You got people with money, you've got people with political power, and obviously on the other side, you have people with less than on both of all that. And so like people with money go free or get bond, and The others don't necessarily.
Yeah, that's why I put the article in here, is that in our adversarial system, it is essential that we bring more parity between the parties that are in the jousting contest. And I think Gideon versus Wainwright was decided some 50 years ago. It just turned 50 recently. And in 50 years, we've really not fully figured out how to provide adequate engine defense resources. And it's far from being anything that resembles an equal jousting contest, because the defense is not only hamstrung by all the rule changes that the victims advocates push through the system, the attorneys that are representing the indigents are so lacking on expert witnesses, the budget that they would need to match the state's vast array of crime laboratories and forensics. The defense can very seldom come anywhere close to that, and they don't have the time to spend with their clients because of the crushing caseload. In terms of gathering facts, they don't have the time to do all the pretrial work that's necessary if you were contemplating taking a case to trial. And it is just tragic that even though the Supreme Court has said it's a constitutional requirement, that it's not an important enough. But if you look at the bottom of the article, it says that better funding for indigent defense is a popular idea. The Brennan Center reports that 71% of voters think it's important to reduce the prison population, and 66% support the use of government tax dollars to provide indigent defense. Now, the politicians that are out there, if that's a reliable number, this may be something that you could possibly sign on to without fear of political harm. Because if it truly 2/3 of the people believe that we should provide sufficient dollars for indigent defense, then that's kind of a no-brainer.
At some point in time, we did not have your Miranda rights, and I think I've heard some Supreme Court justices kind of balk at that's not constitutional, but we could go down that path of talking about having a fair trial. I mean, maybe that would even be like a nexus, like a starting point of having a fair trial, is that you don't have to speak without having representation. Am I headed down a fair path?
Well, clearly you have the right. You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to have no inferences drawn from your not testifying. But just because you have that right doesn't mean that juries don't infer something from. I mean, they are only human.
Fair. Yeah. Right. And if you had nothing to hide, why would you tell the police everything you know?
That's the average person. Well, if I would want the world to know I was innocent, I'd get up there on that stand and I'd tell my story. By golly, that's what an average person's going to think. They don't understand that in any mistake you've made in your life, it's going to be used against you because you opened the door. They don't understand that if you have any minutia wrong whatsoever, they're going to say, and you have to admit that you just told, this is not true, this is not consistent. And then all of a sudden they paint you as a liar and unreliable witness. But the average juror is going to read and infer from your not testifying that you must have had a reason not to testify.
And I use that as like a springboard to then move forward to, you know, you're supposed to have like the equal hands of justice, but attorneys are of different caliber, the DAs versus your defense attorney, whether that be PD or paid for, all of that would come into play. We've talked about what kind of clothing you wear, how you're presented to the court. All of that stuff's going to be used for or against you when you end up in court.
Well, absolutely. And always, I'm quick to defend the quality of the indigent defense in terms of the very few people get called into indigent defense because they want to get rich. That's generally not the career path you would take if you're going to make a lot of money. So there's usually something in their heart that they want to pursue as justice. But despite what's in their heart, if you're getting paid $40 an hour, I think that's what we uncovered in Wisconsin, $40 an hour for your professional services, I'm sorry, but you're just not going to attract the top tier of people that are going to sign up for those public defense contracts in that system they have in Wisconsin. You're not going to do that because lowly paid entry-level attorneys bill out at far greater than $40 an hour in my city, and we're at the middle of the low part of the pack. I mean, people... you seldom find a private attorney billing less than $175, $200 per hour. So it's just like what I say about the prisons. Yes, there's nice people working in prisons. There are people who have great hearts. But when you think about everybody that's listening to this podcast, when you were growing up, how many people did you say, I just can't, when they were expressing their career ambitions, how many of them said, well, when I grow up, Dad, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go straight down to the local jailhouse and apply.
Right.
That was just not a career aspiration that I remember anyone saying.
Definitely not.
In my time. So indigent defense is also in that category that people have great hearts, but they just don't have what they need. And if you take a top tier attorney with the support staff they need, and you put it with the same person accused of the same crime with an overburdened public defender, they can never speak to their client. You remember Epstein was seeing his attorneys every day until his death,
right?
Because he could afford the time for them to come by the detention center and visit, and I'm sure they were charging probably more than $40 an hour.
I would imagine so. They're probably still making money off the whole thing.
Oh, there's gobs of money going to be made off this thing with Epstein. But indigent defense is something where the average citizen doesn't see it as a real problem. They like this poll, if it's accurate, it says, well, they support it. But conceptually, they don't understand why you even need a lawyer because, well, I mean, the police are already overworked. They wouldn't have charged you if you hadn't done something. They must have the goods on you. So
we often bring that up. If you have nothing to hide, then why don't you just go talk to them? I mean, yeah, I'm with you. And that one, Larry, you've told me before, when someone says, if you have nothing to hide, why wouldn't you blah, you know, using an encrypted communication method, you know, you and your boss aren't sharing anything, you know, state secrety, but you use some sort of encrypted messaging app. So, like, you have nothing to hide, right? There's a halfway decent argument to push back on that one I've heard before. I think you've made it.
Well, what I say, I don't know if that's the argument you're talking about. I tell them, well, why don't we search yours? And since we finished with yours, if you have nothing to hide, then we'll go to my place next. But they shame and manipulate people into relenting because of that. If you have nothing to hide, that's one of their favorite lines.
Yeah. All right. Well, then let's move over to Law 360. And I know that you're going to love this article, too. Are prison law libraries falling short on access goals? I know that when I went to the law library, I didn't know what in the F was going on. No clue. Like, could we get a Cliff Notes version of even how to start trying to read stuff in the law library to figure out? But they give you, you know, I think they may give you like 2 hours per week in there. And then the books may be out of date. And then the supplements. And this article covered that they may give you the supplements, but they don't give you the legal briefs, maybe is what it said. But then where was it? Like in Utah, Minnesota, someplace out in the middle of nowhere where they had tablets and the people now have 24-hour a day access to law library information, which sounds stellar. Why can't we do that everywhere, Larry?
Well, I don't think there's anything that would preclude us from doing that other than the will to do it. We already got enough prisoners filing frivolous stuff. And if we made these law libraries stellar, or I mean, they got nothing but time on their hands, and we would be inundated with all these frivolous filings. We can't have that. I mean, don't you understand that?
I don't think that I do understand that. So the crux of the article is that some dude in prison is trying to get something so he can file a habeas, I think. But he had to file a FOIA, a Freedom of Information Act, to get the information that a practicing lawyer would have had access to it just on their legal software. But he had to file a FOIA request to read publicly filed court papers, which sounds, you know, you have to go around your elbow to get to your ass. I mean, that's what it sounds like he had to do.
Well, I'm not an expert on this. We probably ought to have Brandon Sample, which he's cited in this article, who was a former prisoner who became a lawyer. But apparently in 77, the Supreme Court ruled in Bounds versus Smith that inmates must have access to the courts and adequate law books. And that was, I think, authored by Justice Marshall. Thurgood Marshall, that is. And then in 1996, roughly 2 decades later, in Lewis versus Casey, it says on the prisoners that they still have the right to a law library, but they must do more than claim that the materials or their access to them is inadequate. They must be able to show the inadequacy blocked an independent meritorious case. Now, that's a tough thing. When you start showing, trying to prove the lack of something, you're trying to prove a negative.
Right. Yeah, I did catch that in there.
If you don't know what you didn't have access to,
yes,
it's hard to prove that you have a meritorious case. Yeah. So under the more restrictive interpretation of what prisoners have a right to, apparently prisons have taken it less seriously to provide access to legal materials since 77 and 96. And this Wisconsin Department of Corrections, they did not respond to a request for comment. I can't imagine that. Can you?
No, not at all. Not at all. Hey Larry, Chris in chat says he had a prolific typing career while he was down. And so I comment back, Georgia doesn't even have typewriters. And he's like, what in the hell is wrong with Georgia? Yeah, you still have to buy carbon paper on the store and do things in triplicate by, you know, cramming your hand onto some paper to make it go through all three copies.
Does that cramp your ability to produce paper when you're having to?
It would absolutely. How fast can you write, especially with pushing down so hard to make it go through three copies? Unless you actually want to write out three copies individually, which is totally a thing.
I don't see a problem with that.
No, of course not. What would be like? Is there a prison security philosophy behind not giving access to let people have some kind of typewriter? Are they literally trying to gum it up so that these people were found guilty? So F them, they don't get a chance to file mountains of legal paperwork that we have to sift through that they may be innocent.
I think it's a combination of all those things. I think that you have people running correctional systems that have been doing it a long, long time, and evolving technology like simple email, for example. Email would greatly diminish the institutional threat that they allege as administrators that they deal with in terms of contraband coming in, because last time I looked at the internet, I've never seen anybody ship contraband itself through the internet. So all the stuff that they claim that happens with stamps and with stickers and with a seal, the sealed envelope, that would go away. And plus, all the hours that are spent reading letters would go away because you could scan for keywords that would call it that would call attention to, and have human
yes.
eyes look at correspondence. So you could do all that, but it's something about those taxpayers out there when they come and do their tour of the jail. Last thing they want to see is a whole bunch of inmates sat behind computer screens on the taxpayer dime, and so it's a reluctance to adapt to the new technologies that are available. And the law library, volumes of nobody does book research anymore.
Right.
If you were to go to an actual law library in the free world and you pull the volumes, I think they're still printing them. I haven't gone and looked on the what they call them, the stacks in years, but I think they're still printing them. If you were to actually pull one of those books off and open it, there would be such a dust storm that you probably wouldn't be able to have an asthma attack and wouldn't be able to breathe for a week. Because nobody does research that way. It has to be a very, very old attorney who just had refused to adapt to the modern age. So I think the answer to the question is, I think it's the clinging to the past, the public perception, and the initial upfront investment. You've got some investment issues there to adapt to technology. But, you know, it's kind of funny. They're awfully able to adapt to technology in terms of limiting visitation. Oh boy, yes. Are they able to adapt? Particular county jails. They've got it where in county jail settings, it's rare that you even get to visit through the glass anymore, much less
Correct.
A contact visit. And yes. They've adapted the county jails to where you can even pay so much yes. per 15, 30-minute visit.
So they're able to adapt to that. Yeah.
Yeah, they're able to adapt to that technology, but I think maybe the revenue driver has something to do with that adaptation. Maybe they haven't thought about charging the inmates for access to law materials. Maybe they think that might be going over the top. But
that seems like that would put up the hair on some people's necks about having access.
Well, you would think so about basic visitation. I mean, everybody knows that a family support is good for keeping those inmates and their families connected. We already know that.
We know that, but that's not the application of it, because people have that stuff deprived constantly and family separated. Yep. I mean, we constantly talk about that.
Would he pay $12-$15 for an interstate phone call?
Correct.
Because that darn Obama FCC, they tried to restrict that, but then the phone providers took them to court, and they won in court, and saying that that was unconstitutional for them to set, that was price fixing. So right. Now it's fair game again to charge what they want. But if you're an interstate making interstate calls, you can pay some very hefty fees, and that certainly deprives family relationships.
Yes, that went into effect right just before I got out. I'm sure I've spoken about this before, but I would pay $25 to call family in Pennsylvania. And then about 2 months before I got out, they reduced it down to, it was like $4 a call, give or take. I was like, oh my God. But, you know, I wasn't sure that it had taken effect. So, you know, it takes a couple months for a billing cycle to go through. And by the time I had confirmation that the billing cycles had gone through and the price had been reduced, I had gotten released. So it was like, that junk is absurd that we can make phone calls practically to the moon for free, and you have to pay exorbitant rates to have interstate phone calls. It's asinine.
Well,
it's unconscionable.
But you don't believe in a big old bad federal government coming in there and regulating. Those people have to invest gobs of money in having these secure systems. And you don't, I mean, that's what's wrong with this country. So we've got too much government meddling and price fixing and regulation. We've got to free up people to run their businesses as they see fit. If you don't like to make the call at their price, don't make it.
It's okay. Let me play on that one just for a moment. So I use a service.
I know, I totally know it,
but I'm thinking like here's an angle to take. You could go in there and see there's a revenue model in there where like you're putting this all on the backs of the inmates' family essentially. But we use a service to transcribe the podcast that provides me with X number of hours of transcription for free, and I upload it there. It is not perfect, but it comes back. So let's take that over to the inmate phone calls. They could have them transcribed using computer technology. You would have a transcription. You could flag keywords. And now you know whether they're talking about trying to escape or whatnot. And you could then
That's the whole thing I'm talking about. If you adapt to technology, rather than just trying to see how you can fleece the inmate, which is what they do.
Yes.
You could actually run a prison more efficiently. The law library, I think it's a combination of all the above, though. I don't think prison administrators are anxious to see people succeed in their post-conviction challenges. I don't think that's a high priority for them. So I think that also weighs into it. We all they're doing is just sniveling and complaining, and it's over with. They were convicted. They pled guilty. And I don't know why they keep filing all this crap.
I think that actually gives us a really good segue over to an article over on the Marshall Project that talks about when people with intellectual disabilities are punished, parents pay the price. This totally would fit if you were on the registry and your family helped support you that you can't live. And I think this kid actually is on the registry.
Yes.
But the family, you know, like I don't know how they had to move to spend $150,000 a house. And I don't want to like dig into that piece of it. There probably were other places they could live that would have been fitted. But when you are trying to support someone, then the innocent people that like what does society want you to do? Go, hey, you effed up. So F you, I'm going to kick you to the curb. Go find a bridge to live under. Are we that uncompassionate of a society? Is that what we really are?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Next article. Move on. And then to channel my inner Scalia. Well, there's nothing unconstitutional about saying go live under a bridge. Right? I mean, that's where that's going to go.
Well, the point of this is that, and of course, other than rare circumstances, it's hard to buy a house for less than $150,000 that amounts to anything unless you're in a depressed region of the country. But $150,000 is not a heck of a lot for a house anymore. But this parent is they have a son who cannot function without them, even though he's 32 years old. And so therefore, in order for them to make sure he's not out pushing a shopping cart, they had to relocate because of the 500-foot rule, which is in the state of Illinois.
Yes.
And apparently it can be, since he's under supervision, apparently if something springs up, they can force him to move again.
Which, you know, to tailor that to me, a church moved in across the street, two churches, one almost like slightly just off axis straight across, and then one 100 feet away up the street. I was told I'm grandfathered. If I leave, probably can't come back, but at the moment, I'm good. These people in Illinois, if something moves in across the street, school, church, daycare, adios.
Well, that's what it says, and then it says that in addition to buying the house, that she's paying for a son's court-ordered sex offender treatment, which is $23,000. His polygraph tests, which have run $4,000, which doesn't take long if they run $500 or more each. And I know that some states are getting them for $175, $275, but $4,000. And then she mentions the $100 registration fee.
Yep.
Another one said he spent $51,000 in Virginia. For his son.
Yeah. I know that my quote unquote treatment, which was, God, it's like such bullshit, was somewhere around $2,500. But there's a podcast that I reference all the time. It's called Freakonomics. It's from June of 14, I think, maybe it was 15. And they talked about why do we make sex offenders pay and pay and pay and pay and pay. Incredibly good, well-sourced article or a podcast episode that I would strongly recommend everyone listening to the podcast go listen to. And talks about this exact same thing of how much hardship being on the registry puts people.
Oh, well, it's probably something we could have a guest, and his name's escaping me, but he spoke at an Arsenal conference about his son that had intellectual developmental problems and what it's like having to go through this.
This is really shitty, Larry.
Brenda's in chat. She can tell us the name of the person. So
if she feels like it. She's probably going to draw blank for 10 minutes too. Let's move back.
I have everything.
Let's move back over to the appeal where Louisiana prosecutors use the habitual offender statute to jail people for life. Attorneys for lifers are fighting back. Can you, I know I read this article, but nothing is jumping out at me. Can you go over this article?
Well, I put it in here primarily because of the arbitrariness of the crimes that can put you away for a very long time.
Okay.
And Louisiana's worried about their over-incarceration. And then they passed, which Governor Edwards signed, they passed an amendment, Act 282, which was supposed to prospectively change what would qualify for habitual life sentence, but it's not retroactive. So this person does not qualify for any relief under the reform statute that the governor signed. So I'm going to give kudos to Louisiana's largely Republican, but they have a Democratic governor by fluke because they had such a horrible Republican candidate that ran against John Bel Edwards, but they were able to get some measure of reform done. They were able to eliminate the unanimous jury verdicts. They sent that out to the people in the form of a referendum, and that passed. And then they took a step here, so they've taken some steps. But this arbitrariness of seeking life in prison, and this particular person is not going to benefit from the reform.
Yeah, Louisiana is definitely they are a harsh state. What is it about southern states? And like it feels like Louisiana, I guess Alabama and Texas maybe seem to be, man, there's just no compassion and no empathy anywhere in there. That's crazy. Yeah, Mississippi too, sure will.
Yep, Mississippi. But the District Attorneys Association, of course, opposed all this stuff. And they have enormous influence. So,
well, let's move over to courthouse news. This Larry, this one is 100% true. It's probably been a while since you've seen the inside, but man, this is 100% what some jailers will do. It says jailers still interrupting sleep despite order. Bay Area inmates tell judge they were ordered to make the cell house darker, but they still then go in and shine lights in people's faces, and they have people cleaning and using buffers at all hours of the night. And I don't know if I should say wah, wah, wah to the people that are trying to sleep. You know, you just learn to deal with like some noise in the room or in the environment. Like, there's no way that you're going to make a concrete and rods environment silent, but you know, they don't need to shine lights in your face to keep you from getting a halfway decent night's sleep.
Well, I thought it was interesting that they had to take this to federal court and try to get the sheriff to do what the human thing would be to do. But in defense of this particular sheriff, which I don't know jack about him, but when you're running a correctional facility, you always get criticized for what you didn't do and what you should have spotted. Now we're having this inquiry and to find out why Epstein was able to do what he did. And so if you go through cell houses and you have a pitch black at night and you do bed checks without shining any lights and you barely see a pile of something, you see where I'm headed. As an administrator who's responsible for trying to make sure people are not doing horrible things to one another at night and making sure that they actually are living, making sure they haven't escaped, where do you draw? I mean, what is a reasonable amount of inconvenience during the course of a 8-10 hour evening overnight to figure out how often you check and what mechanism, how would you run the facility ideally if it were you running it? What would be a way to keep people safe?
I don't know. I'm thinking to the movie with Clint Eastwood where they were on Alcatraz, I guess that was the name of the movie. And they all had little stuffed pillows and whatnot so that they could, mimic that they were still in bed when the jailers came by so that they could, you know, do all their shenanigans running through the walls to get their escape. Obviously, if you take the lights and shine them in their faces, then you would figure out that these are dummies and mannequins underneath the covers. What would you do? You could use something like heat sensing, cameras, which would be very expensive. So that, you know, you would know if somebody under the blanket is actually generating heat. I don't know how you would generate heat artificially in prison. I'm sure somebody would figure it out.
How would you determine, even though that their body's warm, how would you determine if they're alive?
Well, if they're dead, then who cares? Just kidding.
In the process of dying, though, you could there's a point where you might be able to be revived. Now, I'm not saying that they do bed checks to try to save people from medical emergencies, but theoretically that should be part of what you're doing, even though I doubt it's done on a regular basis.
I don't think they care, man. They're just trying to make sure it's not on my watch that this person died. That's all they care about is like, I didn't lose anybody and no one died on my watch. That's all they care about.
Well, I'd like to think that there are some who actually care about humanity that are working in these places. It's pretty jaded that the whole jail system is filled with non-caring people.
This is the article that's up my alley. It says California legislature bars facial recognition for police body cameras. I am as much of a technology aficionado that I am and follow this stuff so deeply. I am anti them having facial recognition everywhere and cameras everywhere, or at least having very short retention spans. There's way too much stuff that the government can do with those cameras, picking up stuff from ATM machines and all the different security cameras that people have. There's so much stuff that they can discern from you that would take away your First Amendment and your Fourth Amendment freedoms that this facial recognition thing is really bad. But I know where you're going to go with this, and I'm going to spoil it, that this is policy. These are bills and laws being signed that are preventing these things from happening.
Well, I don't know enough about facial recognition. What little I do know scares me. Because I saw an article in one of my magazines recently about I saw that people of minority, and it doesn't have to be just African Americans, but people with have a higher rate of incorrect error matches. Yep. Yes, I saw that, and that disturbs me because it looks like it has a bias.
Yes,
whoever designed this, the computer geek, didn't figure out how to account for the characteristics that make the races different. But what I put it in is because it's showing that you can push back successfully. This is an assembly. I don't know if Governor Newsom has signed it yet. It says that this will now be up to Governor Gavin Newsom's desk for signing. But this is where enough of pushback has happened because of it, and the advocates in California have managed to successfully place this on the governor's desk. I can't picture this getting through a Mississippi legislature.
No.
I can't picture this getting through a Georgia legislature. I think it would be very hard-pressed to get through my legislature because the law enforcement people are so strong.
All right. Well, we know that California is going to be heavily slanted blue. Is it? Are there 18 red players over there and 42 blue? What's the split in California?
It's a pretty significant split. Now, what would be? I didn't take time to do this. It'd be interesting to see if there was any bipartisanship on this, or if it was simply Democratic versus Republican. The Republicans that were on the law enforcement side. And I did not do that analysis, but the vote totals were significant on the legislation.
What's interesting is they have an 80-person body. They only had 60 people vote. Why am I missing 20 people? That seems to be a lot. Well, I'm looking at the Wikipedia page, and sorry, we're doing research like while live on the air. So we had 42 voted for and 18 against. If I'm doing my math right, that's 60. And the Wikipedia page says the lower house, the California State Assembly, has 80 members.
Well, it would mean that a lot of people didn't vote.
What I'm shocked by is I would understand if 2, 3, 5 or something like that. That's 20 people. That's 25%. That seems like a lot.
I'd say it's probably not as scary as what you think it is. People, okay. this is a misconception people have about missed votes. A missed vote. It's not indicative of a person drinking tequila and being laid up somewhere partying. Missed votes could be for any number of reasons. That they can be in floor session and sometimes be having committee meetings at the same time. And those members that have bills that are in that committee leave the floor to go present a bill. There could be a group of constituents that have traveled all the way to Santa Fe from Silver City, and they need to meet and be blessed by their representative, and the representative excuses themselves from the floor, and they go out and give a speech to the and shake hands and do some photo ops with the people. It's a part of politics, but it's so misportrayed in the press that, well, Senator Smith was absent for 42 votes in the last session. Yes, so was Senator Jones.
I've heard of these.
So was Senator so-and-so. I mean, it goes so it doesn't seem like an astronomical number. The more controversial something is, the more likely the absences will diminish, because this is a lopsided victory. If the 20 had been there, it still wouldn't have made any difference if all of them had voted.
That's what I was going to think.
So when something's destined to pass, it's not as critical. When you're confirming a Supreme Court justice and it's going to be pretty close to 50-50, you can rest assured that they'll bring in every senator they can find to make sure that they vote. But I wouldn't read a whole lot into 20 people not voting.
And just to fill in a gap on how this any of this machine learning stuff works, Larry, is you have a sample, you have a certain, you know, you would feed it, I don't know, you pick 10,000 images or something like that, and you train it to recognize the features. If you train the database to only look, that it has only seen criminals, then the system is going to be biased towards people with facial tattoos, the general perception of what criminals look like the stereotype, so to speak. And obviously that runs the gamut. But suppose when you're feeding it your training data, you look at all the people in your office and all that stuff. But if you only feed it, quote unquote, white men, whenever it encounters a non-white man, the error rate's going to go up. It's going to not understand the rules of what other people look like. And that's why these rates are so out of whack when it looks at a black person, African American, pick your terms. They're confused. They think they're doing the right thing, but they haven't been trained adequately to pick up the people of other persuasions other than white men specifically.
So what do we do to fix that?
I honestly think I'll give you two answers. A, stop using it for anything of this sort. But B is, another way to solve this problem is you have competing systems. You actually have a system that is like testing for the results, and then you have another system that is challenging it. And you can make it's almost like, did you see the game movie War Games way back in the day, where the computer played tic-tac-toe millions of times? Yes. And it finally decided, it says, this is an unwinnable game. And so it was testing itself. And that's kind of what they've started doing with a lot of these machine learning systems, is they have one that is trying to figure out the answer, and another one is using like a different algorithm and it's challenging it. And they can do this for hours, hundreds and thousands of times per second. And they improve the system, they iterate through and figure out what the best possible answer is. But you need massive amounts of data and you need massive amounts of horsepower on computers, which we have through Google, through Amazon. We have all that stuff available for us to do these training sets. It's impressive. It is incredibly impressive stuff. I think it is terrible that the government would use it. I think it should like never be used by the government.
Well, all righty. Let's see if we can make that happen in Georgia. Let's follow California.
From KTVU. Sorry, I can't read. I need my my bifocals to be stronger. Ex-felons could soon start serving on juries. Uh-oh, where? California, for the first time. Does anybody, any state allow felons to serve on jury trials now, Larry?
Oh, yes. Yes, they do. We do.
Do you? Like, I'm assuming after all of your sentence and all that stuff. Nobody on paper anywhere, right?
Yes. Well, but now the federal courts have not opened the door yet. But yes, there's no prohibition against a felon serving on a jury here. Now, in all likelihood, a prosecutor is going to consider very much using one of their peremptory challenges. And for those who don't remember, peremptory is a challenge where they don't have to state a reason. If they can't come up with a reason to show bias, they would just use a peremptory to strike the person. But yes, this is another thing where the will of the people is being heard in California. You've got a large disenfranchised population, and we have this right to be tried by jury of our peers, but yet the conviction rate of the minority community is so much higher, and they're excluded from serving. So the legislature, by wide margins, passed this action. And I'm not clear if the governor signed it, Senate Bill 310. Well, anyone with a felony record, now it's interesting, they excluded sex offenders.
But it's that's not surprising.
It goes to Governor Newsom for consideration.
Now, Larry, I find it telling. Let's go back to this. What was the other article from California? Was it the body cams? Yes. Okay, 42 to 18, and this is 47 to 26. Hey, so more people voted, but it seems to be pretty much the same sort of split. Guess how many Republicans are on the California State Senate or the House State Assembly?
Well, I know it's a lopsided. I know that. Inconsequential.
Yeah, it's it's 18 Republicans.
out of how many?
80.
80. Yeah.
So and I'm just laughing because they have 18 Republicans, and on the previous thing we had 42 to 18, and on this one, so they did get some Dems to vote for us. I'm assuming this is pretty much party line split. I'm assuming it is.
Well, yeah, and the listeners in California can correct us, because if it is bipartisan, it'd be nice to at least give some credit for bipartisanship. But I'm suspecting that if it was bipartisan, it was only one or two Republicans that joined in.
Correct.
But yes, this is one of those things where it's, why would you exclude people from serving on a jury because they've made a mistake in their life? What's the rationale for that?
So haven't these people proven that they have a flawed way of thinking and they shouldn't be put in a position to then drive society to their maligned way of thinking?
Well, I don't think you can prove that they had a flawed way of thinking, but if they've paid their debt to society, we don't know that their thinking is still flawed.
But these people have proven to us, like, so forever, we need our pound of flesh forever.
Well, that's kind of what's been happening.
So, can we say that it hasn't been working well?
So it said if the bill is signed by the governor, only Arkansas, Georgia, Kentucky, and Oklahoma will still have lifetime bans for people with felony convictions from ever serving on a jury.
Okay. All right. So in Georgia, as I understand it, you can, after you're done with your stuff, I don't think it's an automatic. I don't think it's challenging. If you recall, like the Florida stuff when they removed their Fourth Amendment thing for the voting, like the governor only let 10 people have it out of thousands. But I think in Georgia, I don't think it's a terribly difficult thing to get your rights back. You may not get your Second Amendment stuff, but I think you get your rights back reasonably easy, and that would put you back on jury duty, I think.
So I'm not sure either.
But you just read off the states that would still leave it to where they don't have the right to serve and all that. And I've said this before, this is an incredibly neat process to be involved in, to where you're going to go sit and listen to the evidence being brought before the two parties, the jousting. I found it to be incredibly interesting, where everyone else is like, ugh, man, jury duty, got to figure out a way to get out of this. I thought it was fascinating to see everything going on.
Well, I'm sure I would. I've only been summoned once, and then I was disqualified because it was a federal jury and I wasn't eligible. But yes, I think it would.
See, I'm thinking it was because of age, because, you know, they wouldn't let anybody over 200.
Yeah, that might have been part of it.
You should have made an age discrimination claim, Larry.
But this is so interesting. A person who's been registered to vote all of their life, who's been in databases all of their life, has never been summoned. And people tell me, well, I get summoned all the time. It just gets on my nerves.
Yes. And I've heard this.
My address is current. I'm one of the most fastidious people about keeping all my information current. And I never received the summons.
That's very bizarre. Do they do it on social? Do they do it on, I don't know. Do they just draw names out of a hat?
Well, I think they use all the various databases to try to make it more representative of the population. And they use voter records, not just voter records, but MVD records, as we call it, not DMV, but the Motor Vehicle Division records. They use a plethora of databases. And I have never received a summons except for once in my entire life.
And I got hit twice outside of roughly a year in the mid-2000s.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Before we get into the juicy stuff, let's hit this final article, the Statesman Journal. Oregon Attorney General Supreme Court ruling could invalidate thousands of convictions. Let's hit this one quickly before we go into the other juicy stuff.
All right. What do you want to hit about it?
What is it? How's this going to happen?
It's a case before the United States Supreme Court that's dealing with non-unanimous jury verdicts. Now Oregon's the only state left because Louisiana changed that. So we're going to find out what the U.S. Supreme Court tells us when they're hearing oral arguments October 7th. And then we'll receive a decision by the end of the term. Could be sooner, but certainly by the end of the term, which will be June 2020. Now it's going to be interesting to watch the split, because they have previously ruled that Oregon has that you have a right to a jury trial, but it doesn't have to be a unanimous verdict. And they ruled that decades ago. And so now they've granted cert and they're revisiting with a new case. And it's going to be interesting to see the decision that's up for scrutiny would be Apodaca versus Oregon, refers to Robert Apodaca and two other Oregon men convicted of felonies whose cases went before the Supreme Court in 1972. And they said it was okay if you had a non-unanimous jury verdict. Now, if you're one of those who believes in the text, I don't think there's anywhere in the Constitution where it says that the jury verdict has to be unanimous. I don't recall that. So if you're a textualist, you'd have to say, well, if the founders and the framers had intended jury verdicts to be unanimous, they would have said that, right?
Yes. And then the legislature would have said, you know, if they were clear enough to say it, then they spoke too. I don't think that this is being ambiguous. So why is there a claim being brought to the Supreme Court then?
Well, because the it's a creative argument, and it's 50 years since they last decided this issue, and And when you're trying to save someone's life, you come up with anything you can, and saying, well, the jury verdict should be unanimous is a good argument. It was compelling enough that they granted review.
And so before we get too far away from it,
what are you supposed to do? Just let just give up on your client and say, well, there's nothing else left to do.
What is significant about letting time pass before a case gets brought back to the Supreme Court?
Well, we don't know how many times that people have tried to get the court to review this. They don't tend to reverse themselves unless the court's makeup changes. So in the intervening decades, they probably had ample opportunity to take other cases, but they chose not to. This could signify that they're going to revisit now that there's only one state that has non-unanimous jury verdicts. It could be that they're ready to decide that since 49 states are doing it, that there is a constitutional requirement. But if you're a strict textualist, I'm not aware of that text being in the Constitution.
And then this would go to that attorney saying that if you look at what history has shown, then there's your evolving standard to go by, that we have 49 states, and that's some level of standard there, that Oregon is the outlier.
Yeah, but don't they have the right to be under the that we have 50 separate governing entities in this country?
Oregon have to? Yeah, why do they have to conform to what the other 49? If they want to be the outlier, let them be the outlier. I don't know. Which way do you think it should be? What is your opinion on the non-unanimous jury argument at all?
Well, as a person who works in criminal defense, I'm looking for every way possible to save a person from conviction. So, of course, I would like unanimous jury verdicts, because it at least makes the jury have to put a lot of peer pressure on the holdouts. But if you like in the case where you have a 10-2 was sufficient, then you can have a couple of holdouts, and you can deliberate around those holdouts.
Yeah.
So it's an additional tool in the arsenal, because with unanimous jury verdicts, you only need one holdout.
Why does it seem to be in my head that you have to be convicted unanimously by a jury of your peers? Why does that seem to be something in my head? Maybe it's folklore. It's a wives' tale. Obviously,
well, because that's the way it's always been, as far as in the states you've been in. But it's not the way it's if you lived in Louisiana, it was not that way until just recently. And if you live in Oregon, it's not that way.
And it's not the way it should be. It's just the way it is.
Well, it was the way it's the way it should be, because the lawmakers in those states decided that they would impose that requirement.
Okay.
But the question is it in the Constitution?
And you've just,
it's not the question. The Constitution does not impose that as a standard. So you could either believe that Constitution has evolved because society has evolved, and society has evolved to where that they've evolved to unanimous jury verdicts in 49 or 50 states, or you can believe, well, if they had intended that, they would have said that. And it ain't for us. We have to give those words what they meant when they were put on that paper. And that's if you don't like that and you want a constitutional amendment, then you need to get to work and pass a constitutional amendment. That's that's also a way that people that take the strict interpretation view, that's a valid interpretation.
Interesting. Okay.
So we'll find out by June or sooner.
Yeah. Okay. All right. You ready to do Scalia?
Oh, I love hearing from Justice Scalia. We missed him for a week or two.
Yes, I don't have the your favorite music behind it, but I'll put that in post.
But I want to pick up on that with a question about meaning of the 14th Amendment. In 1868, when the 39th Congress was debating and ultimately proposing the 14th Amendment, I don't think anybody would have thought that equal protection would have applied to sex discrimination, or certainly not to sexual orientation discrimination. So does that mean that we've gone off on an error by applying to both to sex discrimination?
Sorry to tell you that.
No, that's fine. I'm happy to
If indeed the current society has come to different views, that's fine. You do not need the Constitution to reflect the wishes of the current society. Certainly, the Constitution does not require sexual discrimination on the basis of sex. The only issue is whether it prohibits it. It doesn't. Nobody ever thought that that's what it meant. Nobody ever voted for that. So where do you get it from? If the current society wants to outlaw discrimination by sex, hey, We have things called legislatures, and they enact things called laws. You don't need a constitution to keep things up to date. All you need is a legislature and a ballot box. Things will be as up to date as you like. You don't like the death penalty anymore? That's fine. The Constitution doesn't require it. It simply doesn't forbid it. If you want to eliminate it, you know, vote to eliminate it. You want a right to abortion? To tell you the truth, there's nothing in the Constitution about that. But that doesn't mean you cannot prohibit it. Persuade your fellow citizens it's a good idea and pass a law. You've got the right to abortion. And that's what democracy is all about. It's not about a nine superannuated judges who have been there too long, right? Imposing these demands on society. I don't know how we ever came to that notion that it's anyway.
I really like the framing, and I go through these little rituals of trying to go down a progression of what is he saying, what would be the resolution, and what would be the counter to that, and go forth. And so from what he just said to me, like for the same-sex marriage argument, well, we as a society decided that it started to be okay in a number of states, and that created elevated it up to the Supreme Court. But as Chris just said in chat, then we would then turn around and invalidate the law, which obviously would be like, I mean, that's how it would work. If we don't want something to be legal anymore, we would make it illegal or illegal to do it, but we wouldn't necessarily need a constitutional amendment. But we have such an uninformed vote electorate. We have uninterested people. So that means we leave it to a very small number of people to make the decisions that we all have to live by, which means our democracy has failed.
I don't know if I'd go that far. It's failed.
Yeah, I know. But failing or challenged, you know, I know, and I don't want to say failed as being like it's already done, but that's like where I keep going with most of these things that he says.
Well, I'm trying to illustrate that philosophy that people typically that of the conservative side, they really think they believe in that. Now, what he just told you was that a lot of things that have been pronounced from the Supreme Court that the majority of the justices have read in the Constitution are just simply not there, that they've right. been invented, and I want people to understand that if we want the living Constitution, you won't get that from people like Scalia. The living Constitution, according to Scalia, is threatening as well. And I want to be fair. He says, well, if something can evolve into the Constitution, why can't something evolve out of the Constitution?
So we could evolve out First Amendment. We could evolve out the freedom of speech and assembly and all that.
That's his fear.
That's fair. That's a fair fear.
Yes, he says that if we have a process by which we can amend the Constitution, and we have a process which we can make laws to either allow something or to prohibit something, as long as we're not prohibiting something that's a constitutional right. And most constitutional rights don't have an absolute. He himself has said you don't have an absolute right to possess any type of weapon. He just says right. until the right case comes to the court, we don't know where the boundaries are.
And you don't have an absolute right to free speech. You know, don't say the B word in a movie theater or an airport. You're going to have a bunch of people tackle you.
Yes. I'm really trying to focus a lot on this textual interpretation and this originalism. It has its downsides, folks. That's all I want you to understand. It's not the panacea. The decisions we focused a lot on where they've done strict interpretation of the text, you know, Nebraska, Maryland, different decisions. If you're for textualism, you would be happy as a lark for those decisions, because that's exactly what they've done. They've gone right by the text, and it's just not there. I have a feeling a lot of our people don't like textual interpretations when it's contrary to what they would like the outcome to be.
That's what everybody would do. If I use your words against you, then you know, for something that you weren't. Oh, anyway, I'm going to get myself twisted in a knot. Anyway, if it's not for what you think and I use your words against you, then you're going to be mad at me for using your words against you. I'm sure I didn't say that right.
But you shouldn't be. What you should do is look at yourself and say, wow, I find myself being intellectually inconsistent here.
Yes. Most people will. You've even brought it up. You know, as much as you or I try to be consistent and honest about the things that we talk about and think, we all fall into the trap. Some people are just more willing to fall into the trap than others of being inconsistent. And if you are willing to think this, then you should be willing to also then think that. But like, no, I'm not going to do that because that would be intellectually inconsistent. And I think you and I both try very, very hard to do that. But I don't know that most people are even aware that that is an option or a thing that they're doing. It's my
opinion. Most people don't give it a second thought.
That is correct.
I think I've told the story about when we did the 2013 SORNA amendments in my state. We preempted local governments from imposing any residency proximity type of restrictions, and wasn't a year later that they were talking about there was debate in the Capitol about giving the city of Albuquerque the power to have a teen curfew. And some of our people who tend to lean conservative says, well, I think by golly that'd be good for the city to have a teen curfew. Well, the courts had stricken the curfew we had back in the 90s because they said it was preempted by the state children's code that said that needed to be consistency in terms of juvenile opportunities and juvenile restrictions. So I said, wait a minute, didn't you just ask me to go argue for statewide preemption, saying that the city should not be able to regulate sex? Well, yes, we did do that. I said, well, now if you're turning around saying the city should be able to have their own schemes in terms of how they regulate juveniles, which they can have curfews and they can have these different requirements on juveniles, and it can be a hodgepodge of regulations around the state, isn't that just a tad bit inconsistent?
Yeah.
And they look and they roll their eyes and they say, well, no, I don't see it as inconsistent at all. So we find ourselves in that where we don't even give it a second thought that we're being intellectually dishonest.
All right, Larry, now is your chance to cover, and I asked you this question earlier. So what is like tiering and leveling? Are they different? So we are going to take a deep dive and interesting exploration of what leveling and tiering are.
Okay. Let's see. How much time do we have? Do we have like 3 hours?
7 or 8 minutes.
Hours?
No, just like 4 or 5 minutes. No, I'm kidding. Take as much time as you want.
Well, then let's start with the evolving sex offender registry. When the states were encouraged in 94 to create registries, only a couple states had them at the time the Jacob Wetterling Act passed. The state of Washington had, I know California had since 47, I believe, and I think Washington passed theirs around 1990. But most states didn't have a registry. And the states were encouraged to create these registration schemes or face the loss of some federal funding for crime assistance, their burn justice grants. A lot of the states took an approach where they did an individualized level assessment of the person in terms of their threat to the community. They used various risk prediction models, but they used an individualized risk assessment. Arkansas still does. I think there's a number of states. I can't recite every one of them, but the states did that approach of giving people a level based on their threat to the community, their perceived threat. I think your peach state of Georgia still does that. I don't think they're consistent in getting everyone leveled, but I think they have the process in place.
Yours truly is not leveled.
but that's. And in some states, you derive a benefit from the level. Like, for example, in Arkansas, level ones are not put on the internet. Some states that have that level system, they will shield them from the view of the public. Well, that was 1994. Fast forward to 2006, when the Adam Walsh Act passed. The Adam Walsh Act encouraged a different approach. The Adam Walsh Act encouraged a categorical approach rather than a risk-based approach, because as 12 years of experience had, one of the problems that had been alleged to have surfaced was that too many people, even though they're registering, were not known to the public because these states had these wacky assessment systems that kept too many people invisible from the public. And the advocates for full disclosure say that everybody knows that a registry. I think it was in the quote of one of the cases we posted last week, or I don't remember which one, but everybody knows that if the person's visible to the public, that decreases the chances of them recidivating. So the Adam Walsh Act encouraged states to take a different approach. So they encouraged the states to go away from risk assessments and go to a categorizing the offense by tiers. And the tiers are completely different than an individual risk base. So in a nutshell, if you're a tier one, it means you committed a very minor misdemeanor level offense. Well, there's very few sex offenses that are misdemeanor level, but then if you're tier two, you have a felony offense, but it doesn't involve a minor under age 12. And then those who have used committed violence or had a minor offense against a minor, they would be qualified as a tier three, or those who were previously a tier two who committed another sexual offense could be elevated to a tier three under the categorical approach. So you end up with people. What happened was the states, when they adopted their compliance with federal SORNA to try to preserve their funding, they didn't have advocates from our side actually participating in the process, saying, "Wait a minute, this can be a tier one. This offense, this whole group here you've put in proposing to be in tier three, they can actually be in tier two." So you ended up with a lot of offenses who were put in tier three because, it was a crime against a minor, but that's not what the Adam Walsh Act says. It has to be a minor under 12. And so you ended up with people tiering these crimes incorrectly. But as long as they over-tiered, they're okay, because the spirit of the federal legislation is to provide floors and not ceilings. So you can go above. You can put everybody at lifetime if you like. Then you certainly you've met the minimum of having a tiered system. Everybody's tiered the same. You say the tier ones register for lifetime four times a year. The tier twos register for lifetime four times a year. And the tier threes register for lifetime four times a year. You've got it covered. You've done more than what's required, but you preserve your precious funding by doing that. Well, that's what happened. A lot of folks are in these tiers that do not accurately represent what would have been required. Child porn would be a good example. That doesn't have to be a tier three. It's debatable. If you look at the SORNA compliance sheet, the child porn possession under the federal statute can be tiered as a one. And then if you look at their guidelines for it being a felony that carries more than a year, it should be a tier two. So there's some ambiguity of whether it should be a one or a two, but it certainly doesn't have to be a three. You've got a lot of people who are tiered as a tier three for possession, and they don't have to be. And my state would be an example of that. We have people that are tiered. We don't really have a tier system, but we have a lifetime requirement for that particular offense. And it's not required by that rigid federal criteria. At most, it's a tier two.
Then what is the incentive of the state legislatures to go so far above it and beyond what is actually required? Seems like they would normally just go, if we have to, we'll go do the minimum. Like, what is their incentive to go beyond?
Well, they don't know that they're going beyond. Again, the law enforcement apparatus is the only apparatus there. When these bills are proposed, they've been written by law enforcement. They've been taken up to the legislature seeking sponsorship by the Attorney General's office, by the Association of District Attorneys, by the Sheriff's Association, or blah, blah, blah. And they have given them the legislation they would like to see, and they say, "Well, looks pretty good to me." And they have a bill drafter draft it, and they put it into the system. And when our advocates are not there with the expertise to push back, for example, like on the 5 years on a tier one can be reduced from 15 years to 10 years if the person picks up no felony conviction. There are a number of states who have not bothered to put that in there because no one mentioned it. The law enforcement apparatus didn't mention it, and no one mentioned that that was an option. Then, for example, like on this ridiculous system that California just passed for removal, it's so silly because under the rigid federal requirements, no petition need be filed. So what California did is they created a so-called tiering system of registrants, and then a tier one's not required to file anything. A Tier 2 is not required to file anything. A Tier 2 would just automatically time off after 25 years. So they created something that wasn't required, and it's going to make a lot of money for attorneys. Not a soul is ever going to get off. I take that back. I'm not supposed to say that. Very few people are going to get off in California under the system they've designed because of the complexity and the innocuous burden of proof and the way they've geared it in favor of law enforcement, and the fact that you have to file with the police first, and then you have to go to the district attorney, and then the district attorney has to notify the victim, and blah, 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 blah. Very few people will get off. But it didn't even need to be there. Just you needed to file anything, because the people, as I understand it, the people that are lifetime, I don't believe they're ever eligible to file, but I would like to clarify that. But certainly the Tier 1s and 2s, they don't need to file anything. If they had followed what the federal recommendations are, they would just simply time those people out.
So these leveling things aren't the panacea that people think they are.
Well, the tier system and the leveling system are not the same thing. The leveling system has its own set of problems, because people who have non-contact offenses, they assume that they would magically be Tier 1. That is a misguided, erroneous assumption from the get-go. People who have non-contact offenses are often, under these risk-based models, predicted to be very high risk. So they start with the non-contact offenders think, well, if we just have a risk-based system, my life will be all so much better because I'll be a low risk. Well, that is assuming something that the evidence doesn't show. But beyond that, the complexity of who pays for it. Well, I tell people, I say, well, let's just go through a little exercise. All right, so, okay, you want a risk-based system. Okay, who do you want to perform the evaluation for you? Well, do you want it to be your sheriff's department that you register? Well, no, I wouldn't want it to be. Okay, well, who would you like to do it? Okay, well, so you want a group of professionals. Okay, well, that costs money. So you want psychologists and treatment. We're going to create a sex offender assessment board in your state. Okay, well, that costs money to staff. Okay, so now those people are going to need support staff, because you've got a conviction from Maine. You moved to Arkansas, so they've got to figure out what you did in Maine. They've got to look at a bunch of stuff, so they need support staff. So we just created a bureaucracy to assign your risk. Okay, now all right now. Okay, so they call you in for your risk assessment, and they assign you a level that you don't agree with, because unless you assume that they magically get it right, that you and them will see eye to eye on everything. So then when you get your letter saying, we declare you a risk level 3, okay, now what? Okay, well, what do you want to do next? Okay, well, yeah, I'd like to appeal. Okay, well, what would you like the appeal to look like? Would you like to have to file in court, or would you like to have an administrative hearing first before you go to court? Because it can be usually handled more expeditiously. Oh, okay, so you want to but now you got to have an administrative hearing. You got to have an administrative law judge. That administrative law judge is going to need to have a salary, so they're going to have to need to have support staff. Okay, so you have to prepare for administrative law judge hearing. Okay, well, it's kind of like the Social Security disability determination. You should go before an ALJ. Okay, but if you don't agree with the administrative law judge, then what? You think you should have to go to court, right? Okay, you should go to court. All right, okay. So you file in court. Okay, you have no money because you're working at a $7.25 an hour job. Who do you think would pay for your representation? Because you're in court, it gets far more complicated. You even need an attorney in the administrative law judge level, but now you're in court. Who's going to pay? Okay, wait a minute. So the assessment board said you're level 3. You need money to pay for your counter-assessment, where you're going to argue that you should be a level 1 or 2. Who's going to pay for your assessment? Because your $7.25 an hour won't cover that. Are you going to provide funding for indigent representation and for indigent expertise? Are you going to provide? That's a tough sell to a state that's never had that model, to go present all those complexities and say, I'd like to create a bureaucracy to do these risk assessments. I'd like to staff it. And it would be an ongoing bureaucracy that would never die, because until you abolish the registry, it would be an ongoing in perpetuity. I want to create an appellate process. I want to fund indigent representation. And I want to do all this in a time of lean budgets, where we don't have a lot of spare cash. And so I'd like you to prioritize and shift some money out of education and out of parks and out of roads to do this. Try selling that and tell me how well you do. It's just not an easy sell. That was more than what you wanted to hear.
It is like my eyes are still swirling. I don't know that I can even like come up with a cogent question to ask you. Is there anything else you want to say about this before we go on to some listener questions?
Well, Well, there are advantages to the risk system. There are also disadvantages. I just illuminated several of them. The advantages are for the people who it works for, and they actually derive a benefit from it, like a shorter period of registration or shielding from the public. It's a good thing for them. But for the people, it's like anything in our system. If it works for you, it's a great thing. But yeah. If you end up with no money and they level you to 3 and you can't do anything about it, you probably would not be screaming from the rooftops about what a great system it is for you.
All right. I now have a question for you.
You do? All right.
I do. Do you want to go over to Will's voicemail question, or do you want me to read the next question?
Well, I love Will's question, but we'll all save right. it for last. This,
oh, wait, we're going to save it? Question. Okay, so we'll save that for the best for last then.
We'll save the best for last.
So we have a question from listener Jay, and it says, denying voter rights to felons, aren't states violating the Constitution because the 15th Amendment, which says, right of citizens of the United States to vote, shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. When you are a prisoner, that is a condition of servitude. And thank you, guys and guests.
I wish I had a better answer for this, because I don't really know the origin on the felon disenfranchisement and how that has been held to be constitutional.
Jim Crow laws, right?
Certainly, we recognize that all rights are not absolute, but merely a felony conviction for disenfranchisement has always troubled me. It's troubled me, even though I'm not a big gun toter, it's troubled me that you can never, ever possess under federal law. You can never defend yourself again. So Martha Stewart, for lying to the investigator, can never carry a weapon lawfully again.
And this doesn't fit into the realm of amendments. This is like you don't have a constitutionally amended right to vote. You have a constitutionally protected, like in the We the People part, to vote.
And I don't know enough to explain. It's troubling to me, but I don't know how that they've managed to deny that right to so many for so long. But there has been an effort to re-enfranchise felons. I mean, that we've been moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
I think we can all acknowledge that.
All right. Well, sorry we don't have a better answer for you, but it obviously troubles Larry. And I'm with you. We perhaps, at least like as soon as you're done with your sentence, perhaps while you're still, but you know, we talk about that too. There are what, 2 states that allow you to vote while you're still in prison, and 20-something will allow you some sort of procedure to get your voting rights back. And then there are those places, there's a dozen or so that you just never get it back. I think that was roughly how it split out.
It's pretty much automatic in a lot of states after you've served your time. I know in my state it is. You don't have to file anything with anybody. You're just automatically eligible again. You go down to register, and theoretically the supervising officials, when they closed your supervision, they file a notice of eligibility for restoration. And if they fail to do that, which with human beings, sometimes those certificates of completion are not filed. But you don't need any type of pardon or any type of special permission. You just simply have to have exhausted the totality of your sentence, and then you're automatically re-enfranchised in my state. And that's the case in a large right. number of states.
Is there anything we can do to delay Will's question any further? Because he's in chat. He's screaming and jumping up and down like a 3-year-old because we're delaying his question. Is there anything else we can do?
I think you should find his IP address and disconnect him from our
We finally figured out a way to to use that ports expression. All right, here's Will's question.
This is Will from Tennessee, and I have a question for Larry.
Because, look, Larry, nobody's asking me questions, so any question that comes in has to immediately just go to you. There's no reason that anybody's going to ask me a question. Anyway, I digress.
This is Will from Tennessee, and I have a question for Larry. Was the applicability of severability ever decided for the Michigan sex offender registry law? And how much longer is the court going to give the state to fix the problem now that the 90-day window has been surpassed? Thank you, and to all you people who support the registry, you're such friendly young people. Thank you for all you do. Have a great day.
Did you catch that he said, now that the window has closed?
Well, then he said, support the registry. I think he means the Registry Matters podcast, rather than support the registry. Hopefully we don't have a lot of registry supporters here, but I think he meant the Registry Matters podcast. But Will and everybody listening, It's hard to answer that question. I can give you my best guess based on the political analysis. Keep in mind, the courts can never require the legislature to legislate. They can merely provide them the window of time to do that, which they did. And if that window has closed, I haven't tracked this case with a calendaring system. If that window has in fact closed, I'll take his word for it, then exactly what I said, what my prediction was, has come to fruition. I did not think they would legislate, because the incentive to legislate from a political perspective is too risky. The political analysis is that if we do anything, now this is the political analysis, not me, but the political analysis would be, if we do anything, we run the risk of being vilified if we seem to be soft on sex offenders. And there will always be the possibility that an opponent can say we did something we didn't have to do. Well, there's one way to make sure that risk never comes true is to don't do anything at all. And then if you don't do anything at all, then any fallout goes to the courts. And it's like the California overcrowding in the prisons. The courts just said, we're fed up. You cannot be this far over your design capacity. But the courts got blamed for releasing people. They didn't release a soul. They just said, you can't keep but X number of people in these facilities that you have. You can build more if you like. But the same thing is going to happen here, in my view, with Michigan. The court is going to have a couple of options. What they're going to do is they're going to have consultations with the parties and find out if any progress is being made. And the ACLU is going to say, oh, yes, so there's lots of progress. We're in good negotiations and everybody's working in good faith, because the ACLU doesn't want the court to solve this. The ACLU feels like if the court solves this, all they're going to do is carve out the escalations that they did in 2006 and 2011. And then the registry will be as it was, with many of its of problems that they would like to see addressed by legislation. So the ACLU is looking for a comprehensive fix that will go beyond 2006 and the elevations of 2006 and 11. Well, the court is going to say, well, if you're making progress, we're going to give you a little bit more time, because the last thing the court wants to do is to do the same thing the politicians don't want to do. They don't want to be blamed for turning loose hundreds and hundreds of, if not thousands, I don't know the number, but potentially thousands of people from the registry. So the court's going to say, well, all right, if there's progress being made, we'll allow more time. And then with that extra time, the politicians are going to feel less pressure to do anything. So you've got this vicious cycle working, where at some point the court's going to say, clearly, there's going to be no legislation. And then the court's going to be faced with the next part of what they have to do. And that's, we've said this is unconstitutional, particularly in view of the 2006 and 2011 amendments. So then they're going to need to know if Michigan law provides for severability. And there's two ways where severability can be an option. It can be in the statute itself. It can say, if any section of this law is declared to be unconstitutional, the surviving sections shall remain in effect. To be honest, I haven't read the entire Michigan sex offender registration statute. I don't know if such a clause is in there. If that's not in there, then they would have to take a look at that state's jurisprudence, existing case law. If there's not a whole lot of case law on point, the best place to go would be the state Supreme Court. So what the Federal Court of Appeals would do is they would certify a question actually, it's probably been remanded back to the trial level court. But what the federal court would do is they would certify a question to the state Supreme Court, and they would say, we would like to know if the Sex Offender Registration Act is severable, if any provision is declared unconstitutional, if it can be severed, and if the remainder of the statute can be saved. And the Supreme Court of Michigan can say, nice, you'd like to know that. We don't feel like answering it. Or they can issue an opinion on the certified question. And they can say, yes, we think it's severable. No, we think it's not. And I have no idea how they'll answer that question, if they'll answer it, and which way they'll answer that question, if it comes to that point. If they were to determine that it is severable, then the court would be likely to say, all right, you cannot enforce these two unconstitutional provisions, and the registry continues to exist the way it is. If they were to say that it's not severable, then the court has a real, real big problem. Because then, if the whole statutory scheme is unconstitutional, then what? Because if the court says, all right, well, then the entire thing crashes, I can absolutely assure you that the pressure would go up on the lawmakers exponentially at that point, because Michigan at that point would be without a registration scheme. Because if it's unconstitutional, it's applied to everybody prior to a certain date, you would be talking about many thousands of people who would be potentially without a requirement to register. Well, that would be an inspiration to lawmakers. At that point, they don't have no incentive to legislate. They would all of a sudden have an incentive to legislate, because their phones would be ringing off the hook, and they'd say, "We're about to have 11,000 people in our state no longer required to register. You better get with it." So that's the trajectory this case could take. Is we could have a lot of, if they decide it's not severable, and the federal court says, "Well, RH can't enforce." The severable clauses, you can enforce remainder, then you don't have the larger problem. But if the Supreme Court says that it's not severable, then you've got the federal court's going to be in a real conundrum, because they're going to have to say, gee, how much time do we give the legislature to legislate to fix this before they can no longer enforce it? And I think they would really be serious at that point. They would say, you've got 180 days or whatever to fix this, and then you can no longer enforce this, and this is your one time to get it done. And I bet they would get it done at that point.
Will has a couple follow-up questions, and I think you've already answered them, but just to make sure that these go through. So basically, they're going to allow them to dawdle for an indeterminate amount of time, and so there may never be any meaningful conclusions. And then the last one is, in summary, this can keep dragging on for years without resolution. I think you answered all of those as, this is going to go forever.
If the parties, when the court says, if the parties say we're at loggerheads, we can't do anything here, that's going to be different. But the ACLU is not going to say that. They would have absolutely no reason to say that, and they would have every reason to say just the opposite of that, because they want a resolution legislatively. They do not want, yes. Now I'm stating their public position. And I'm not speaking for them. This is their public position that they have stated. They do not want just to no longer have enforcement of those unconstitutional provisions that caused the court to find that it violated the ex post facto clause. They are not going to want to go in and say, Judge, I mean, all hope is gone. So if there's anything that they can hang their hat on and say that there's a glimmer of hope, they're going to want to try to have a legislative fix that goes beyond what they think that they can most likely achieve with the court. And so I suspect that as long as the court believes that progress is being made, at some point they will close the door. If this goes on and on, at some point the court's going to say, we've heard this story, this song and dance before, and this case needs to come to a conclusion. But it affects so many people, and it's such a significant issue. The court is not going to want to be hasty and premature. They're not going to, I mean, even no matter how liberal the court is and how much they hate the registry, they also have kids that go to school. They also live in communities, and they don't want their throat sliced, and they don't want to be the one who lets thousands of people no longer have any accountability. So the courts are not chomping at the bit to crash the Michigan registry. And I'm sorry to have to say that, but they're not.
Larry, this, I've been following the gerrymandering stuff that goes in these different jurisdictions around. This feels similar as far as like, hey, this was deemed an unconstitutional election map, and it goes to the court says this is unconstitutional, redraw the map. And I think in one of those cases the court said, okay, you guys have effed up so bad, we're going to draw your map for you. I think, and maybe Wisconsin or somebody like that, that's what the end result was. But this feels very similar as far as like the procedure, like the trajectory and path that it's taking from what you're describing to me.
It could very well be that, but they won't be able, the courts won't be able to create their own registration scheme. They will be able to possibly extricate the things that no longer can enforce. They'll extract that from the law if they believe that it is, that the severability is option is there. But the court cannot impose its own registration scheme. Now, they do that, like the New Hampshire Supreme Court, and I think another Supreme Court recently did that. They said the registry has evolved to be unconstitutional, but if it had due process, it would be constitutional. So therefore, you have a right to due process, but there was no legislative due process established. Nobody knows what to file, what to call, what to do, what the requirements are, the burden of proof, who should be in the most cockamamie ruling I've ever heard of. But as a general rule, the courts are not supposed to be legislators. They're supposed to be interpreters.
Yes, and they are not supposed to be like the action enablers. They are supposed to just say yes, they're a thumbs up or thumbs down, and then the legislature is supposed to act up after that. They're the ones
correct,
that would actually do the doing.
And the courts are far more restrained now. The decisions that we used to see in the 60s and 70s, we're not likely to see those today. I mean, busing was a very, very controversial thing back in the 70s, school busing. And you're just not likely to see that. Schools were, in many ways, just as segregated as they were back in those days. But that's just that was the courts were far more interventionist then. They were trying to cure a public policy ill, and they were willing to take drastic measures. The I don't see the courts being anywhere near that activist today, because the temperament of the judicial appointees at the federal level has been moving constantly and constantly further towards the right, and I don't see them wanting to take that level of activism. And so I suspect the court's going to give more time as long as there's evidence of some progress being made.
Alrighty then. Is there anything else at all that we could possibly cover on this podcast now that is like 7 days long?
Oh, it's only 2 hours long.
Larry, how can people find the podcast if they should be so inclined that they want to find the website that this podcast is hosted at? I'm purposely giving you a lot of time for you to open up the document and find the website.
Well, it's easy. It's www, but nobody does that anymore. Remember how they used to do that? Yeah.
Yes.
Nobody does that anymore. Registrymatters.co.
And is that a .com?
No, it's a .co.
Okay, I just want clarity because someone did a .com and I was like, no!
Now, I remember listening to talk shows when they would have guests back in the early days of the internet, back in the 90s, and they'd say, give us your website. And they would say, www.blah, blah, blah, / upside down character / what happened to all that stuff? I mean, by the time they gave out their, you would have exhausted every piece of paper you had in your stock to try to write down their website address. What happened to all those long / and / and special characters that they used to have in their addresses?
We have learned to not make people have to do, typing jumping jacks to type in a URL, and that we've shortened it, but you can still find some crazy. Someone posted one in chat just a few minutes ago, and it takes up the entire page of all kinds of little switches and bells and whistles. I'm trying to find it. Yeah. Somebody posted an article to Engadget that has, it's 500 characters long. I don't know. Yeah. It's all the tracking information there, but otherwise, no, none of that stuff exists anymore.
So, or you could do what Will did, and we threatened to disconnect the phone, so at least we got a call. But you could call 747-227-4477, and that is exactly the length of question that we're looking for.
Yes, and awesome question. Thank you, Will.
It's succinct, and it's something that more than just one person is interested in. There are a lot of people out there interested in, not only that live in Michigan, but they're interested across the country because they want to know if litigation is successful, what's going to happen. This is a case study unfolding in front of you about what's going to happen when you win a case. And if you look at the Munez decision out of Pennsylvania, these are all case studies telling you about what's going to happen. Or if you look in Maryland, the Department of Public Safety, the DPS decisions about how long it took people to get relief, there's no instantaneous relief likely to come with a victory. So these are good questions because it helps people understand that these things are not going to happen overnight.
Very much so. All right, and then, so where are we? You just gave out the phone number, and then what about supporting the podcast? Oh, wait, about email. Well, sorry, I missed email.
Yeah, yes, that's registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
Outstanding. And then what is our most bestest, favoritest way for people to support the podcast?
Oh, that's patreon.com, and we better spell that because we've had so many new signups, we don't want anyone to lose track of how to find Patreon.
And that's patreon.com/registrymatters.
And it will search function for you if you go to Patreon.
Yes, it will. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow us on Twitter. You can find us on our YouTube channel. All of these things are Registry Matters. Certainly would love everyone to go out and friend us on Twitter or become friends, whatever. Follow us, friend, follow, and then YouTube, sign up. All that stuff would help us. If you don't want to support or if you can't support the podcast, please go to your favorite podcasting app, iTunes, or wherever you get it and write a 5-star review so that more of our people can find us and help us move this whole shenanigans SH train down the path to making it better for everybody.
We would like to be talking to thousands of people every week because we feel like the information we're providing is very helpful to people. And I don't know of another source. Honestly, I don't.
I do not. I agree. Chris in chat tonight said, how in the world does Larry know this stuff? He is an incredible resource of information. I've paraphrased a little bit, but he said something like that. So there you go.
I've spent my life in being a nerd, I guess would be how I've learned. I'm sitting at home reading and studying when everybody's out having a good time. So
perfect. Larry, as always, I can't thank you enough. And as Chris said, you are an unbelievable resource of information, and I don't think we could do it without you. I appreciate it, and I hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks, everybody. And I'm headed to the fair, so good night.
Enjoy. Take care. Bye.